Good evening. You're listening to They Came From the North. Normally, your weekly and decidedly Canadian look at all your favorite filmmakers in Hollywood and around the world. However, this week we're doing something a little bit different. We were planning to study the works of Sam Peckinpah, but we're down a man, and I can't really say unfortunately because she's a very lovely woman, but Steve and his wife, the Lady Power, have decided to go on a little romantic getaway to celebrate their wedding anniversary. So we decided we're going to hold off till we're at full capacity. Instead, we, myself and the guys, decided we're going to, what was it you said, Gabe?
Shoot the shit.
Shoot the shit. Fantastic. We're going to just shoot the shit about anything we've been seeing in theater lately, stuff we've been checking out on TV or on video, you know, even some books and comic books we picked up. You know, basically a one big happy media clusterfuck. So, yeah, we're going to take our original format. We're giving it the Shawinigan handshake. So, with that, let's get started. Who wants to go first?
I'll take a shot at it.
Awesome.
All right.
I'm going to pour a beer.
Sounds good. Well, I thought I'd talk about a couple of movies I saw in theater this summer. Summer is a bit of a broad term in this case because I'm going back to, like, April for Cabin in the Woods.
Actually, to tell you the truth, summer begins in April now thanks to stuff like Fast Five. And
it might even start in March. But yeah, Cabin in the Woods is one of two movies I wanted to talk about. It's a movie, obviously, sort of in the nerdy Joss Whedon fanboy community. It got a lot of hype and love, but I think maybe a broader audience didn't really get a chance to see it or didn't even know what to expect and so didn't bother. But it was, I think, really one of the gems of the summer movie season. It's
man, the best horror movies I actually find are the ones where you don't get what you were expecting.
Yeah, and you definitely don't in this movie. I mean, it's essentially nonstop deflating the cliches that you expect from the Cabin in the Woods movie, where, you know, you've got your small number of attractive people going off into the woods to have sex and then get murdered. But Joss Whedon, who co-wrote it, with the director whose name escapes me at the moment.
Drew
Goddard?
Yes, Drew Goddard.
Yeah. I wanted to say Drew Struzan because of our previous conversation. But yeah, they co-wrote it. It's got all the earmarks of a Joss Whedon script. I mean, it's really clever, witty banter. But I think, you know, people who may be scared away by that, those who, you know, find some of his work, especially stuff like Buffy, just way too cute and some of his turns of phrase a bit too over-molded, probably won't mind Cabin in the Woods as much as some of that stuff. It's constantly funny and constantly intelligent. And obviously, it's, you know, aware of horror movie conventions, but it's not taking the cute scream approach. It's a genuine horror movie with, you know, some very disturbing, violent moments.
I've asked you a question.
Yeah.
Because I am going to tell the truth here. My wife, we missed this in theaters. And she did try to download a copy of it just to check it out, but it was a cam, and we as soon as we saw that, we just deleted the file, right? It's not even worth trying it. The opening scene, we caught Bradley Whitford in it.
Yeah, and he's one of the highlights of the movie.
Okay, I was going to say that because Bradley Whitford in the right role is just an absolute fucking delight, right? So, I was – as soon as I saw that, I was thinking, you know, this is definitely something I think I'm going to be picking up on day one.
Yeah, I mean, the story sort of alternates between two settings, and I don't want to give too much away, but there's our standard sort of creepy woods setting and then a sterile government facility type setting. In the facility, you've got Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins, sort of these two solid workhorse character actors who have fantastic comic timing. And they're, like, they move the plot along, sort of maintain the mystery of what's going on in the movie. The movie's really good at sort of unfolding its hand at just the right time and keeping the tension while also bringing a lot of humor into it. And Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford are really good at selling both sort of the seriousness of the scenario and getting laughs when they should.
I'm picturing a lot of deadpan.
There is some very good deadpan in this.
Fantastic.
The other highlight of the cast in the sort of small group who go to the cabin is Fran Kranz, who, if any of you out there have watched Dollhouse, which is a Whedon series, he's Topher Brink, the sort of playful, slightly irresponsible genius behind the Dollhouse technology, and he is absolutely perfect in this. He plays sort of the standard loser, loner, stoner type, but brings a ton of humor to it. So, and like I said, I mean, it's a movie that manages to really effectively balance like genuine tension and humor, which is so hard to do.
Again, see Scream.
Yeah, exactly. And this movie, like, it just ends up sort of developing and developing and keeping it, like, you think you're sort of, like, you think it's gotten as crazy as it's going to get, and it gets crazier. So it's really hard to talk about without spoiling anything. But keep an eye out for Merman. So that's Cabin in the Woods. I recommend it.
Nice.
The second movie I wanted to talk about, I'll be a bit briefer with this one, is Moonrise Kingdom. Any of you who don't like Wes Anderson movies, tune out right now. Because this is the most Wes Andersonian of all Wes Anderson's movies, I think. It's got like all of those sort of like super symmetrical compositions and deliberate pacing and deadpan, bizarre humor. It's got the classic rock soundtrack. It's got the, you know, very, very, I'd say twee, kind of hipstery, indie kind of vibe. But it's also genuinely kind of moving.
Yeah.
It's a pretty conventional storyline. It's a coming-of-age tale, sort of like young romance kind of thing. So in terms of the story it's telling, it's really nothing new. But the characters are definitely distinct from anything I think anyone's likely to have seen before. It's got some fantastic gags in it. And one thing that I'm not sure everybody would have noticed is the climax is this great sort of like visual nod to silent film. Like it feels like it could be out of Nosferatu. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like you've suddenly changed. It's not like a grindhouse style, like we're going to stylize this now. You don't really notice it. But the way he composes the climax, which is sort of on the roof of a church, feels like a blue-tinted silent film.
Cool.
With these characters sort of creeping along the top. It's really well done.
I think you mentioned a good point about Anderson is that whatever the backlash you may get, most of his movies just feel genuine to me, and they don't feel like they're trying to be the hipster thing, you know? They come from a real place, I find, most of the time.
I mean, a lot of movies that, like, that just absolutely strain Garden State to be,
yeah,
to be, like, indie and quirky. And Anderson's films are indie and quirky, but I always get the sense that, like, it's actually who he is, as opposed to just, like,
well, man, I think he kind of predates the whole hipster thing anyway.
It's kind of like, you know,
you he's more of a beatnik.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And he's really one of those directors that you either love or you hate, I think. I mean, if you don't get one of his movies, you won't get any of his movies.
If he's good enough for Bill Murray, he's good enough for me.
My head just started hurting because I'm thinking about Garden State again.
I'm sorry.
Whoa.
Oh, God, that movie was terrible.
Oh, Zach Braff, a.k.a. Akbar.
Such a punchable face.
So.
I hear JD stands for just die. Yeah, it's been a... I haven't gotten to as many movies in the theater this summer as I'd like to anymore. You know, it's... I got a kid now, so I don't... And I live half an hour away from the city and go out every day for work, so...
Oh, delightful groin spawn. How they make life livable. I'm sorry, you probably love your kid.
My kid. My other child is my PlayStation. No, it's... So I'm probably going to end up going a little bit bigger budget than what Andrew's been talking about. I'm not going to get into The Dark Knight Rises. That is the most recent thing I've seen, but Gabe hasn't seen it yet. And suffice to say, you know, it was enjoyable. Hopefully one week we'll sit down and dissect the works of Chris Nolan, so we'll get to talk about his Batman trilogy a little bit more.
Prestige.
Dude, I love The Prestige.
My favorite Nolan movie.
But then I love the book, too, so. Mm-hmm.
But we're not doing that now.
No. So, first things first, I don't know if I've done this before. I believe I got into this on an episode of Blast Processing, so I'd just like to apologize to everyone for any mean things I said about Joss Whedon in the lead-up to The Avengers. Because, you know, I checked that out the weekend it opened, and Joss stepped up to the plate on what could have been a very, very messy strike, and he knocked it out of the park. Mm-hmm. You know, that is... It was a movie that I should have, by all rights, been crazy excited about for years and years and years. And I wasn't wowed by the advertising campaign at all. I kind of avoided any of the Comic-Con stuff that went on about it and went into it and... You know, had
the marketing was heavy on the spectacles.
Yeah, and I gotta say, I came out of that one feeling exactly the same as I came out of Batman in 1989. Just I felt like a kid,
mm-hmm.
And it was really funny because I wasn't originally planning to actually go see it in theaters. I was just gonna wait it out, and then I saw one last trailer for it, and came to the realization that. John, this is the movie you've been waiting for since you read Secret Wars when you were, like, 5 or 6. You know, this is, if you don't go see this, you need to turn in your comic geek badge right away.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, you know, I love to say I told you so.
Yeah.
So I told you so.
it was great. And, you know, very, very entertaining. And that's all it needed to be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say there are sort of a couple of things that bug me about it. You know, the main threat is kind of generic. We've seen it before. And there were a couple of moments that, you know, were a little, went sort of a cheap laugh. I think both of them involving the Hulk attacking someone.
Yeah.
But those are like super, super minor complaints given what.
I was kind of worried about the whole. The villains of the movie type deal because the weaker comic book movies are always ones like something like Fantastic Four where, you know, they don't really introduce the villain early enough in the film. Mm-hmm. Right. And, at least with the Avengers, you know, you had Tom Hiddleston hamming it up a little bit, but
he, you know, it's, I think hamming is a bit unfair. I mean, he twists the mustache, but
he does what he needs to do, and he's great in the role. You know, he was fantastic in Thor. He's even better in the Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
And without that, that last act would have felt utterly disastrous. But it's also unfortunately, you know, when the last act starts to unfold and the shit hits the fan and the Avengers, you know, start putting boot to ass. Outside of one of those moments you were talking about with the Hulk, he, Loki kind of disappears, right? Mm. During that last fight sequence. And it's, that's a little tiny bit sad.
Yeah.
But, I mean, besides that, it's, you know, it's near perfect popcorn entertainment.
Agreed.
Yeah, and it's a, it was a satisfying payoff to what Marvel are, I believe they called it Phase 1.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They've already started their plan, unleashed a few of their planned things for Phase 2.
Yeah, all sequels, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we got some sequels, and then there's Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, and like Ant-Man, Edgar Wright.
Yeah. Is that still happening?
Yeah, I think that was confirmed. Yeah.
Oh.
And I believe it was just announced today, as of this recording today, that Joss Whedon's actually signed on to write and direct the sequel to The Avengers. Which, you know, if anything, that's, no matter what your feelings are on Whedon, that's, you know, he did a good job with the first one, and it's always a strong sign if you've got the same, same creative mind behind the sequel. You know,
it's always good to have some continuity.
Yes,
yeah,
it's very,
in terms of how you're treating the characters.
Yeah. Unless your director's Jon Favreau.
Yeah.
And I don't really know what else I could talk about in theaters. I mean, we already got into Prometheus on the Ridley Scott episode.
Mm-hmm.
And, God, it's been a fairly...
Or Conmetheus, as some of us like to call it.
Oh,
if you want labored puns, I've got them for you.
Like, I really don't see what your blind hatred of Michael Douglas has to do with Prometheus. How about you, Gabe? Have you seen anything in the theaters recently?
Not really. I mostly go to watch, like, revivals of, like, old movies. When I go to theater, I kind of boycott, like, the...
You cultured French bastard.
No, it's just mostly apathy. Like, I don't feel pushed to go out of my home and to go see a movie, you know? I'll just
being apathetic is part of being cultured. You put on your beret, you be weary of the world, you read your philosophy books, and you go see Three Penny Opera.
Yeah, the French version of Three Penny Opera.
Of course.
No, because, like, I went to see it, because if I had the choice, I would have seen the original German version, because, of course, it's much better, right?
It's filmed in French.
So. Yeah, it was filmed in French, and it's still the same movie, but... You know, having Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht songs in French is just not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I've only seen like that and the Gold Rush at a like old movie revival they had at my art house. But I did go see, Liza Minnelli live.
Ooh.
Which was pretty amazing.
Were there sequins?
Not really. Just a big black dress and sitting on she was sitting on a stool for like 2 or 3 songs because, you know, she's 66, so she needs to sit down once in a while, but she still used it as a tool, you know, for her songs. So she was still doing like theatrical stuff while using the stool.
So Gabe went and saw Liza Minnelli, I saw Iron Maiden, and that tells you all you need to know about They Came from the North.
Hey, I love Maiden as well, but I've seen tribute bands, so, you know. Hey, I'm going to see Neil Young this November.
Hey.
How cool is that?
Maybe some common ground.
I hate Neil Young. Oh, no, wait, no, I hate Neil Diamond.
Oh,
You came so close to murder there.
Yeah.
Considering he's like Canada's version of Uncle Sam.
And, I mean, I've seen Opeth like 3 times, so it's not like I don't dig metal either.
We won't get into metal. I don't want to lose my club membership.
But, yeah, not much outside entertainment besides that.
I have a couple of video things I've been watching I can talk about.
Nice. Let's get on to it.
Both of them are a little bit old school, some more than others. Actually, the more recent of the two is from 1981. So that tells you how far back I'm going. So first one I want to talk about, is the described by Peter Cushing as the worst movie he ever appeared in, The Blood Beast Terror. this is absolutely not sort of high point Hammer quality horror filmmaking, but it's, you know, it's fun to watch. It's basically about a killer moth monster who sucks blood or needs blood injected or something. It's very vaguely defined. And
there is blood involved, though.
There's blood. There is a beast. The terror is slightly more debatable. But you know what? Despite the fact that he obviously hated the movie, Peter Cushing, you know, being the professional, sweet gentleman he was, by all accounts, you know, really gives a great performance, even though it's pretty terrible. I mean, the movie's obviously cheap, and a number of the scenes kind of look like they were shot with a single light being held above the camera by a spare grip. But at the same time, it's Peter Cushing. I can watch Peter Cushing in anything. And so it was pretty great. But that's basically all I have to say about that one. Don't bother seeking it out. Look for his better movies. Look for, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein and, there's this really great Peter Cushing movie that a lot of people haven't seen that I would recommend in place about a bank heist. It was made in the early 60s and it was called something. I recommend it. Don't remember the name, but yeah. Look for that if you can. So I'm going to move on.
Was that Cash on Demand?
Maybe it was Cash on Demand. I believe it was.
He's the bank manager and Andre yes. Morel was the robber?
Oh, great movie. That's it. Cash on Demand. Highly recommended. Little, tiny, tiny little Christmas time British thriller. Very intelligent.
Scrooge set to a bank. Oh my God. That's fantastic.
I cannot recommend it enough. It was released in a little Hammer Films. It was called Icons of Suspense Collection. It was called released. I can't remember who released it. It might have been Image, but a really, you know, as DVD goes, really good video quality, and you get a few good movies in there. But the other video I was going to talk about, I posted a bit, you know, a couple weeks ago on it, on Facebook, is a movie that Peter Hyams made really well, I assume by accident, based on every other Peter Hyams movie I've seen.
End of Days was genius, man.
Christine York. Christ in New York. No, Outland is awesome. It's essentially an outer space version of High Noon with Sean Connery as this disgraced minor cop sent to the ass end of space on Io to police a very, it turns out, corrupt mining operation.
And I also got to add, man, I fucking love the beginning when he really, really subtly, as in not at all subtly, suggest that he beats his son.
Yeah. Oh, Connery. How we miss you. Yeah, I mean, the movie is better than any movie about a cop on the moon of Jupiter hunting drug dealers has any right to be. Like, the cast is all, like, the characters are all sort of types, but they're played really well and they're interesting types. You know, Connery is this sort of aging, somewhat washed up. As I said, you know, he's a disgraced cop. We're never given a lot of details on his past, but you get the sense that he keeps getting moved around and never really finds a home. He comes to this moon, is introduced to Peter Boyle, who's this like incredibly slimy, corrupt, you know, civilian corporate manager of the mine, who basically tells him to, you know, shut his eyes and take whatever money comes his way.
Francis Sternhagen was fucking amazing in this movie,
yeah,
too.
Francis Sternhagen, like, makes this movie. That's one of the great things about it, is you don't get the standard kind of, like, romantic interest. You get this great female character, which, I mean, at the time was even, I think, more unusual.
Well, considering she's manlier than Sean Connery.
Yeah. But, I mean, she's this, like, cynical, I mean, she's also somewhat disgraced. She's basically a bad doctor and says as much. That's why she's working in a mine on a moon of Jupiter. She doesn't really know how to do her job that well. She's cynical. She's pretty much, you know, picking up a paycheck and letting the bodies coast through her little doctor's office. And, you know, until Connery sort of recruits her to help on this little mission to find out what's at the bottom of all these mysterious deaths. Workers keep killing themselves or dying in mysterious circumstances. So, it's just like a unusually good sci-fi movie. Lots of sweet old school effects, miniatures, exploding heads, Connery, you know, even though he's Sean Connery, like, he sells the fact that he's essentially a loser. Like, he's a loser who basically this is his last chance to do anything worthwhile. You know, he's intelligent. He's, you know, he's got good instincts, but he's not a natural leader. And he apparently keeps just, you know, messing up everything he tries to do. But he decides he's going to do something right this time. And Connery totally sells it. It's an awesome, awesome movie.
Nice.
You've seen it, John. Any extra thoughts on that?
Well, we already spoken about Peter Boyle, you know, being, you know, if you've seen, it's really, really weird seeing, you know, Raymond's dad just so slimy.
As someone who hates with just a burning passion, Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yeah.
Sitcoms
in general, I would.
I avoided it every chance I got. So what that means is that, you know, when I go back and watch these old Peter Boyle performances, I feel like they're not poisoned by that. Because most people know him from that. And he does so much better work.
There's also, for anyone who's seen the odd few times he showed up in 80s cinema, usually playing a villain or a heavy, Stephen Burkoff
turns up in Outland. And dead center forehead mole.
Yep, and he is
just a psycho.
Yeah.
If you like the greatest drug freak out of all time, possibly.
Which one was Burkoff? Which freak out was he?
He was when, you know, they sort of orchestrated, like, Connery at the door talking him out of it while James Sicking sort of went around through the vent.
Okay.
Speaking of James Sicking, like, I don't think I've seen him in anything else, but he's like this, he does a really good job as this, I don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, his character ends up revealing some unexpected motivations. But he's this really awesome sort of, like, friendly kind of, like, equally old and weary.
Fantastic beard, by the way. Like, when I first started watching, I thought it was Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
Okay, I had to look this up because I remembered I saw a movie where Peter Boyle was playing a pretty shady character, and it's the movie Hardcore, directed by Paul Schrader.
That's an amazing movie.
Yeah.
So absolutely soul-destroying.
But, yeah, it's just like when you said Peter Boyle playing a city guy, it's like, to me, it's not that different from that role or even from Taxi Driver a little.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see Peter Boyle in movies like The Dream Team, and you remember what it was like to be happy.
If you want to see a fantastic use of footage from Hardcore, I strongly recommend
Jack and Jill, right?
Mashup, which is George C. Scott watching Jill trailer. It's amazing.
Yeah. Especially when you know what George C. Scott is actually viewing.
So those are my video picks for recent watching.
Nice. I did a really bad thing in home video recently. And I've been joking about it for a while, and then, you know, my wife got together with a bunch of the girls, you know, her and Steve's wife, and just a bunch of the ladies all got together, and they went and checked out Magic Mike in theater. Hmm. And after about 4 days straight of hearing about nothing but Channing Tatum's abs, I decided, you know, revenge was in order. And I didn't explicitly go out looking for this, but I kind of felt called to it at HMV. And for $10, I picked up the entire, well, not the entire filmography, but the best of the selected filmography of Andy Sedaris. For anyone who didn't pick up on that, that was a hiss of pain from Mr. Forbes. That was the lemon face.
Renée Zellweger?
Extreme lemon face.
And I've been telling everyone, you know, there's 12 movies in the collection.
I had no idea that you could buy a collection of Andy Sedaris movies.
And they essentially came out to about 83 cents each. And part of me would argue that I still got gypped. Okay, because these movies are, except for the first one in the collection is actually a bit of tongue-in-cheek fun called Malibu Express, but the rest of them are all just goddamn horrible.
Even Picasso Trigger?
Especially Picasso Trigger. Picasso Trigger is actually the, there was like a 3 or 4 movie series in the collection that were actually kind of pseudo sequels to one another. The main male character, was always some guy with the last name Abilene. Right? There's like a family.
Cody Abilene.
Cody Abilene, Rowdy Abilene, right? They're kind of like this loosely connected family of crime fighters, and all four of them had Donna Spear in it. And, you know, the movies are, it's hilarious because you can actually tell when a scene was ADR'd as opposed to when it was actually recorded on set, because the ones that were recorded on set, there's like a really bad hiss in the background, almost as bad as Andrew's Renée Zellweger impersonation back there.
Okay, Hard Ticket to Hawaii, I have to mention. This is the one that features Rowdy Abilene.
Was the first one I watched in the box, actually.
Played by Ron Moss, who is a soap star who kind of looks like a combination of Max Headroom and Sinestro.
Jesus Christ. I never saw that.
I don't know how else to describe him.
What else was this guy in? Bolt. He did a voice in Bolt.
He's been on The Bold and the Beautiful for like, let's see, 2,493 episodes.
And his name is Ridge Forrester.
Yep.
That's almost as good as Rowdy Abilene. Hard Ticket to Hawaii, by the way, guys, is so bad that it's hilariously bad. Like, this is a movie that has a frisbee covered in razor blades.
Oh, sweet.
And has a sequence in it where the two male heroes are just arrived on the big island, and they're driving to meet up with the girls on the team, who are all played by former Playboy playmates, as with every Andy Sedaris movie. And they're driving up the road in their Jeep, and a guy comes by on a skateboard, doing a handstand on the skateboard, I might add. And they make the comment that, you know, he must have been smoking some pretty heavy doobies. The guy on the skateboard jumps in the back of what looks like a combination between a Jeep and an El Camino. And drives back up the hill he just skateboarded down, only to get back out of the car with a rifle and a blow-up doll.
As you do.
A blow up. He uses the blow up doll to hide the gun as he's escaping. Which doesn't really work because as soon as he enters frame, it's you hear like the really bad ADR of "Look out! He's got a gun." And then he opens fire, hits one of them. The two of them turn around in the Jeep, run him over. He bounces over the hood and goes about 30 feet in the air. And Rowdy reaches into the backseat of the Jeep and takes out a four-barreled rocket launcher, not unlike the one Arnold Schwarzenegger used in Commando, and shoots him out of the air, and then turns and shoots the blow-up doll. My jaw was on the floor. I was like, I couldn't believe I actually just witnessed that.
I have to watch this movie. The tagline is, "This ain't no hula."
It's a hard ticket to Hawaii. The tagline of the trailer is even better. An unending paradise. It's a great place to visit, but you wouldn't want to die there.
Ooh. So then where would you want to die?
So they, these are just unbelievably horrible, yet strangely fun movies. You know, it's like, as typical of the direct-to-video action fair of the 80s, no girl can be on screen for more than 3 seconds without removing her top. Right? The acting is terrible.
I kind of feel like Channing Tatum can't possibly require ammunition this heavy.
Man, when, you know, when she whips out the Channing Tatum bomb, I got to drop the Ron Moss. And that leads into, you know, I caught up recently on a lot of movies I'd shown a little tiny bit of interest to in theaters but never went to see just because, you know, I didn't want to pay, you know, between $10 and $15 to go see Man on a Ledge.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of these little just disposable thriller movies. They're a great way to kill an evening. It's a bit of fun, but, you know, I don't want to go to the movie theater, and video stores are really, really drying up here in Newfoundland, so
you're
kind of limited in your options here.
Sam Worthington isn't really worth paying for if he's not surrounded by spectacle.
Yeah. And there was actually this is actually really funny. I'm working on a book now in my spare time. And the main character in it, I described him just in my notes and everything as having a mild Australian accent. The whole reason is it's the joke that, you know, you got these guys like Sam Worthington, yeah, ever since Hugh Jackman, really.
Yeah.
All these Australian actors kind of getting the American tough guy roles.
Mm-hmm.
Yet Sam Worthington can't hide his accent worth a shit.
No, he can't.
He's terrible at it. And you're like, I'm wondering how much better it'd be if he just didn't try. Mm-hmm. Like, for some reason, in Wrath of the Titans, Perseus is from Coogee Beach.
Well, it's like the first time I saw Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade in English, and I heard Sean Connery trying to do the American accent, and I was like, oh my god, what did you even
he
try?
Tried to do an American accent?
No, he didn't, Gabe. You just heard Sean Connery.
No, at some point, I think he was trying to have an American accent.
I think it's probably a little bit, yeah.
In my native Ukraine, I'm known as the Vilnius schoolmaster.
It's from all these years of just hearing it in dubbed in French that I noticed the difference of usual Sean Connery voice, I guess.
Sean Connery is such a confused man. I mean, he was born and raised in the desert, you know, being an Egyptian.
Yeah.
Despite his name, which is what in Highlander again?
Juan Esteban Ramirez Villalobos. No, Ramirez is his last name. Sorry. Juan.
Anyway, yeah. Very typical Egyptian name.
Yeah.
Right there. But he's, you know, he's also a Berber, you know, an American from somewhere in Middle America. Also a Lithuanian Soviet sub-commander who just never manages to shake this strange Highland accent.
But, oh, I totally lost my train. Oh, yes, we were talking about Sam Worthington and Man on a Ledge, which really wasn't worth the money, by the way.
Mm.
And yeah, no, I just checked out a bunch of really, really bad action and thriller movies, and realized that maybe I didn't get gypped with the Andy Sedaris collection. The Man on a Ledge was completely unspectacular for a movie about a guy jumping who's threatening to jump off a building. I checked out, Man on a Ledge, Wrath of the Titans, which was a better movie than Clash of the Titans, but that's really not saying much.
Did all the characters' clothing occupy the same plane of existence as they did?
No. No, not at all. What else was there? Oh, God. Safe House, which was actually pretty good.
Safe House was pretty solid. I saw that on a plane.
Yeah.
I didn't really want to comment on it because I felt like, how could I really do it justice? But it was decent.
Yeah, it was pretty good. And, I don't know what it is. The past few years, man, it's like, you see a movie with Denzel Washington, even if it's something like Unstoppable, right? He's full go.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The man only has the one set. And it was, Safe House was actually pretty good. A movie that seemed tailor-made for me, and I've actually, I have a feeling that Luc Besson actually has constructed a time machine and stolen a story I wrote in, like, grade 3. I checked out Lockout.
The story you're thinking of, he stole from John Carpenter in 1980.
I know, I checked out Lockout, and which is worth seeing just to see Guy Pearce try with every fiber of his being to everyone else assumes they're making a serious movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Guy Pearce just takes it by the scruff of the neck and tries to drag it kicking and screaming into the realm of Total Recall. Right? It's his performance is absolutely jaw-dropping. But it really, really saddens me that the crop of directors that kind of came up from that came from were spawned by Luc Besson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these guys are getting, stuff like Lockout is reaching theaters, and Rennie Harlan's last movie was a John Cena.
Yeah, 12 Rounds. Film.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, Peter Himes hasn't really had a fair shake in recent years. Although he did that one Beyond Reasonable Doubt, didn't he?
Oh, maybe. All his movies are beyond reason.
Yeah. No, you got all these action directors who were, fairly solid hands in the late 80s and, early to mid-90s. These guys cannot catch a break. And Oliver Megaton gets to... Gets to release 6 Transporter movies this year.
I have to get.
He does have the explosive power.
That's like a really bad supervillain name.
Yeah, I have to.
Before we get any further, I really want to say that I was just looking on IMDb, and I think Luc Besson may have the most ironic credit of the year for Lockout because he's credited with original idea.
That's actually hilarious. That's actually hilarious.
Actually, hilarious.
There's one thing I do have to give to the Besson school, or whatever you want to call it, and it's Unleashed.
God damn it, Gabe. Fifth Element was 1997.
No, I said Unleashed.
Okay.
But gently. Because that's a Luc Besson script or something, and that one was pretty good.
You can also probably thank Luc Besson for
for the professional Leon
actually giving Jason Statham a career,
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in what other universe would Jason Statham, like a bald, I don't know, is he Cockney? Anyway, extremely working class British bald man have a career taking his shirt off and beating up people through it. Well, there is a Freudian slip for you. It's kind of appropriate for some of the Transporter movies.
Wasn't he in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, though?
He was. I mean, he came up through the Guy Ritchie
show. Yeah.
But, you know, I kind of think that his current career is entirely about kicking people in the head.
Yeah, for sure.
And
dude, I can still remember. I had to review The Transporter when I was in university. I used to write movie reviews for the student paper. And my original title, this didn't make it for the review, this didn't make it into the paper, was When the Fuck Did Jason Statham Learn Kung Fu? Because that shit in 2001 came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Or 2002, sorry. Yeah, because I still saw him as Bacon or Turkish, right?
I just assumed he was just going to gain a whole bunch of weight.
Yeah. You know, he's going to turn into the British version of Tom Sizemore. And instead, he has, like, you know, has the most rippling abs ever. Like, maybe he's a Terminator.
Maybe. A male pattern baldness Terminator.
Yeah. And, like, every one of his movies now is revolves around him saying oi and kicking the ever-living shit out of everyone.
He's playing Parker. He's in a Parker movie next year.
Is that a good or bad thing?
Donald D. Westlake, a.k.a. Payback, with Porter.
You mean like Lee Marvin?
Yeah, he's playing Parker in Parker 2013. That could actually be amazing, except Jennifer Lopez is in it.
But I guess Parker was the guy from Point Blank, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But then Jennifer Lopez was also in Out of Sight, so you never know.
Out of Sight was directed by Steven Soderbergh, was it not?
Yes,
and Parker will be directed by Taylor Hackford.
So there's a major difference between Taylor Hackford and Steven Soderbergh.
Yes, but it does have Nolte in it.
You know, Steven Soderbergh managed to get a believable performance out of a porn star and a cage fighter. If only for the fact that he could surround them with basically character actor royalty. You know, these people are basically awesome by osmosis.
Mm.
We promised we were going to talk about comic books.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gabe, well, I don't care what you've seen on video recently. Let's talk about comic books.
Yeah, let's go.
Mrs. Mercer just gave me the smile. I'm a loser. Or maybe she's still mad at me about the Andy Sedaris collection.
She's mad at you because you said that Jason Statham had the most rippling abs when we all know.
It's cheating, cheating.
Yeah.
But
enough of this. Let's talk about Jack Kirby a little. I've just finished reading the first omnibus of The Fourth World, and I think my jaw is still on the floor.
Can I let you guys in on a little secret? I've never read The Fourth World.
Hey, neither have I. But now you've shared it with everyone.
To quote Mitch Hathaway, it's equally brilliant and nutty in the same measure.
That's my favorite kind of equally.
So it's a comic book from the 70s, you're saying?
Yeah, and all coming directly from Jack Kirby's id.
Does anyone get hit with a giant fly swatter?
Because
that would be amazing.
No, but there are such things as the boom tube and a four-armed creature which was created in the DNA lab by Darkseid's assistants.
Ooh.
Basically, Darkseid's origin is from the Fourth World. A lot of those characters were created by Kirby for the Fourth World. And later recuperated by two of them were recuperated by Grant Morrison for Seven Soldiers of Victory, Mr. Miracle and the Guardian. And of course, they do show up again in Morrison's Final Crisis as well.
Also, I think it should serve notes. Anyone who hasn't checked for the animated series, Justice League Unlimited, there's a couple of episodes of that that revolve entirely around Mr. Miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And are fucking amazing. I can't remember. So they had somebody awesome do his voice, too. I'm going to look that up now. I'm going to Google that shit.
But yeah, basically, like, DC was like, come over here, Jack, and we'll let you do whatever you want.
Ian Griffith. How do you pronounce his last name?
Ian Griffith, I think, is how you're supposed to say it.
I think it's actually pronounced Yone, actually. we're talking about Mr. Fantastic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's he from? Is he Welsh?
Welsh or Irish?
Mm-hmm.
Wales.
Yep.
Yeah. There you go. So,
Sheepshanger.
So that was my latest in a long summer of a lot of buys. I went through all of Grant Morrison's latest Batman mark, starting with Batman and Son and going up to Batman Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
All of that stuff with the Final Crisis and Batman and Robin, and like it's just incredible what he managed to do, how many plot threads he had like in the air and just managed to tie them all up, and so many ideas. And he's one of those guys that like I feel can make comics fun again, you know, after all the grimy Watchmen, Dark Knight Returns inspired 90s. He brings, although there's a lot of realism to it, like there's some pretty sick stuff, especially in Batman and Robin with Professor Pig.
If you're looking for a good, actually, recent Batman story, Gabe, check out one called The Black Mirror.
That's the new 52 stuff, right? Scott Snyder?
Yeah, Scott Snyder, and most of the art was done by Jock. The guy who
the Losers.
The Losers.
Yeah.
And Jock and Francisco Francavilla did a few issues of it. But that is, I picked it up because it was described to me as, you know, this is the new Batman, The Long Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And while it's not quite The Long Halloween, you know, but that's a goddamn awesome series. It was actually, I was surprised how good it was. You know, I tried to stay away from the, after the whole Batman RIP thing, because I just, you know, that was a stupid fucking idea to begin with. And,
no, I loved it. Seriously, but, eh.
You know, but Batman the Black Mirror kind of, it's, you know, you're getting into the whole Dick Grayson as Batman thing, and it's just, the way it's written is absolutely fantastic.
And is Damian Wayne still Robin in that?
There isn't any Robin in it.
Okay.
It's entirely Batman. And just, there's a great sequence in it where he's interrogating this guy who's got a pair of mechanical legs, right? Not like superhuman mechanical, but just metal legs.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddy's going on about how, the whole reason criminals are the way they are in Gotham, you know, the reason they're not afraid of anything, or the reason they're willing to go so far, is this is a guy who used to steal cars in Metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, had Superman basically fly underneath a car, lift it up, fly him, you know, to the nearest police station and say, son, you're going to want to think of a career.
Think of what you've done.
Yeah, right? And he said, after you've had that happen, you know, what can Batman? Batman's just a man. To which Dick responds by just smashing one of his legs.
Yeah.
Just complete, no anger in it whatsoever, just completely nonchalantly just buckling this guy's leg in.
I would be far more terrified of Batman than of Superman.
Well, so would
yeah,
I.
Yeah, for sure. But, like...
But, I mean, it's lucky, you know, it's new Batman. It wasn't like Bruce Wayne, it would have been, you know, punch him until he pees blood.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What are you going to do, man? I've seen Super... Oh, God, stop! No! No! Not my kidneys!
I need those to pee.
But yeah, I'm finding.
The scum who sells drugs to school children. I don't sell no drugs.
That one really interests me a lot, but I've also picked up the new Batwoman, the two trades. The first one written by Greg Rucka and drawn by J.H. Williams III, and the second one written by co-written by J.H. Williams III, and they're fan-freaking amazing.
Yeah, for the uninitiated, Greg Rucka is one of the few writers in comics that can actually pull off awesome female characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Creator Whiteout, right? Which is
excellent. Whiteout, Queen and Country.
And for,
amazing stuff.
And for those who don't know, J.H. Williams III is one of the top pencilers in the business right now. He's got a very, very distinctive style that no one can imitate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just beautiful just to look at it, and you're entranced.
And
even
like,
if you're
crazy,
not
like kinetic kind of like spreads with just stuff just splashing across the screen. Or screen, page.
And
in the wrong mode.
What really impressed me is that the second book, which wasn't written by Rucka, was even better than the first one. And, I mean, they just keep delving into her psychology and her past, and it's really interesting. And they decided to make her a lesbian, and it doesn't feel like a cheap ploy. It's just part of the character, and that's it. It's not like, oh, we're getting a gay guy into Archie Comics type of thing.
Yeah, that artwork is gorgeous.
Or attempt to like excite 14-year-old boys.
I just took a look at it. That artwork is gorgeous.
Oh, it's jaw-droppingly amazing.
It's like crazy.
Yeah, Williams is mostly known for having drawn Alan Moore's Promethea.
He did Desolation Jones, too.
Yeah, too, for Warren Ellis.
Does the same guy do the interiors as does the covers?
Yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's keep the same kind of color scheme inside and everything. I love the way the red stands out.
Yeah, it's very distinctive. And, like, there's this flowing quality to his work. That feels almost animated in a way. And almost like, there are certain parts where I feel like it's almost like cel shading a little, like the look.
Mm.
But yeah, that's a great series, and it's got me intrigued by the other, like, titles in the new 52. I have to admit that I've always mostly been a DC Vertigo guy more than a Marvel guy.
I'm something has me kind of interested. I don't collect monthly titles. You know, I'm the type who waits for the trade paperback.
Yeah, I do the same.
I like having the full story there to flip through, and it's very few times. You know, I'll get in. I'll actually. I try to get into like a major storyline if I'm told it's been handled really well. Like I stopped reading comic books around Jesus. When was Maximum Clonage? That horrible Spider-Man story. Early to mid 90s, right? That's kind of when I punched my ticket. And, you know, I couldn't...
You couldn't ride out Rob Liefeld?
No, I couldn't. It was just that was a...
That's when I started, but, you know, I started with, like, the old Animal, Morrison Animal Man and Alan Moore and all that stuff, so...
Oh, no, I'm not saying there wasn't good stuff back then, guys. It's just, you know, I...
There was a lot of terrible
stuff. There was a lot of terrible stuff. But I kind of got back into... you know, I picked up a Batman and a story called Hush.
Mm-hmm. Jim Lee, right?
Yeah, it wasn't written the best. I mean, Loeb is... I'm not going to lie to anyone and say Jeff Loeb's a great comic book writer, because he's not. But 12 issues of Jim Lee penciling Batman. is well worth it, right? Especially since the entire story existed as a reason to let Jim Lee draw Batman's entire rogues gallery.
I have I have five words for you: All-Star Batman and Robin.
Yeah, but I I picked up the Black Mirror, read through that. I really enjoyed it. I even went out and I checked out. There's a major DC event called Blackest Night, which, if anything else, man, it just, I can't believe that, you know, like these, I was never much of a Green Lantern fan or anything like that, but it was actually, for what it was a cool little event. I'm really excited. Everyone's been telling me this, story they've been doing in Batman recently, the Court of Owls and Night of the Owls is actually, a lot of fun, and it's I'm really excited because Greg Capullo is working on it, and Capullo was, I felt, a penciler who in the, you know, everyone kind of wrote off in the 90s because he was, you know, basically Todd McFarlane's understudy on Spawn.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, despite the fact he's a better artist than McFarlane. See, I'm kind of... I'm interested. Holy crap, Capullo's got an awesome mustache.
I don't know. It kind of looks like he's been drinking tar and it just kind of dribbled down the sides.
No, man. It looks like he's working at the Gold and Silver Pawn Shop in Vegas. For me, for the longest while, the only comic books I were reading was, you know, the absolutely mind-blowingly amazing Conan series Dark Horse has been running since 2003.
Is Bazique still on that, or?
Sorry?
Is Kurt Bazique still doing that, or?
No. As of, they just finished the latest book that just came out, Volume 11, The Road of Kings, was the, I believe, 40th anniversary of Marvel's Conan series.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave a year's worth of the storyline. They actually had Roy Howard write it. Oh, God, what was his
Ron
name?
Ron Howard?
No. look, this is going to be something stupid now when I look this up.
Oh, now I'm just imagining Opie doing Conan.
Yeah.
Roy Thomas.
Hmm.
Okay.
Who used to write Conan back in the 70s for Marvel. They gave him a significant amount of story. For a couple years prior, it's been Tim Truman. And before that, it was Busaic.
Yeah.
Now, Busaic stuff really stands out to me because, you know, a lot of it was just adaptations of the Howard stories, but he had it really fleshed out well. And Truman stuff has been more connected. You know, it's kind of not every story just opens with Conan waking up drunk in a town or wandering drunk into a town, you know. Busaic stuff was very much young Conan, bull in a china shop. Truman stuff, you're starting to see he's growing more intelligent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Becoming wise to civilization's tricks and, figuring out ways around them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's a fantastic series. I really recommend to anyone who enjoys comic books in any regard. It's Conan is just amazing, amazing stuff. But, I mean, I've been reading nothing but stuff like that since 2004. And I really wanted to try to just get a good superhero story. And I was told at the local shop about this guy Dan Slott, which is – that's a fantastic last name, by the way. has apparently been doing wondrous things with Spider-Man.
Hmm.
Now, you know, I loved Spider-Man when I was a kid. And I'm not going to lie to you, I even enjoyed the first two Tobey Maguire movies.
Mm-hmm.
To a degree, anyway. And but, you know, the 90s were not kind to Spider-Man. You know, you had, like, severe over-reliance on symbiote-based villains, you know, because Venom was so popular. And you had that
Carnage.
Embarrassing close-up. Yeah, you had the horribly embarrassing Clone Saga. But this guy Slott, I actually picked up three books he wrote. There's I picked up one called Big Time, one called Spider Island, and a new one that just came out called To the Ends of the Earth, which was you know, he's really gone back to Spidey's roots, and it's, you know, there's a bunch, it's classic, like To the Ends of the Earth is a Sinister Six story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just the storytelling's really, really fast paced, really kinetic. The artwork is gorgeous. The art, he kind of trades off issues between this guy Stefano Caselli, who's a fantastic Italian penciler, and Humberto Ramos, who was a guy kind of came on scene during the later years of the whole Image boom in the 90s, but who has improved by leaps and bounds. And kind of, you know, it's got this really goofy cartoonish style that really fits Spider-Man.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, the stories, they've been a ton of fun. It's great seeing, like, Big Time was all about, you know, Spider-Man basically finally hitting a string of good luck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, they did a, not really did away with all of the angst, because, I mean, you know, there's still the whole great power, great responsibility deal, but it's just, it's a really, really well-written superhero comic that's not at all pretentious, and, you know, after years of reading shit like Mark Miller, it's really refreshing.
Breath of fresh air.
Yeah, just to have, you know, colorful tights and daring do.
Yeah.
Right? I'd say that mostly, like, I've got these authors that I will read, like Warren Ellis or Grant Morrison or, like, those kind of people, or Terry Moore. And I
is
don't
Terry Moore Strangers in Paradise?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a great book.
And Echo
amazing is book. Amazing. The first trade of Rachel Rising was very promising. Very different direction for Mr. Moore. But, you know, those kinds of people, I don't really follow, like, the major storylines. But, like, if someone's writing a book, like, say, when Grant Morrison is writing Batman, of course I'll read it because it's Grant Morrison, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to do a bit of a gear shift here because I've been sort of reading a rather eclectic mix of comics lately, sort of a mix of some superhero stuff and a lot of more, I guess, I don't know, what's the term? Naturalistic fiction. So one book
you
I want to talk about.
Hipster douche.
One book I want to talk about, which I've been like posting about all over Facebook for weeks because I want everyone to read it, is Green River Killer, which is this amazing book about I don't want to say it's about the serial killer who was working near Seattle in the 80s, but it's really more about the lead investigator on the case, who sort of like almost came in, almost arrived in his career as a homicide investigator by accident in a way. I mean, he started out in burglary. He was, you know, had a Navy background, but he really just sort of saw himself as a regular family guy. And ended up having this really strange, relationship with Gary Leon Ridgway, who was, the murderer in question, walking through these crime scenes. Basically they'd made an arrangement with this guy where if he could show them all of these buried bodies, he would, instead of getting the death penalty, he'd get life in prison. So he basically lived with this guy, you know, for months and months and months while they were going over all of these details. And so you get this strange kind of very humanistic portrait of a serial killer as just like this guy they have to deal with. And the strange situation of living with a guy, having to be civil with him, almost sort of coming to get used to him, but realizing sort of the awful things he did. So everybody should go read that. It's amazing.
Yeah, I feel that crime comics are often forgotten, and there's some really good stuff. I really,
yeah,
really enjoyed Brian Bendis's Torso.
Torso's amazing.
Yeah.
That's one I read a little while ago. Really, really good. I liked a lot more than Goldfish, which I read recently, and I thought was a little too cute in some ways, and you know, trying to be a typical sort of film noir style story. The femme fatale is actually named Lauren Bacall. I mean, that's lazy and ridiculous.
Well, that's what you get with Bendis sometimes.
Yeah, but Torso was amazing. So yeah, Green River Killer, it's actually written by the son of the investigator it's following. So it's, you get this very sort of intimate portrait of this guy. Another book I, read really recently, is an adaptation of, William Hope Hodgson's House on the Borderland, which is this, a British supernatural horror novel, turn of the century. It was around 1907, I think, that he wrote it. Hugely influential on guys like H.P. Lovecraft, mm-hmm. Sort of dealing with these sort of forces from another plane of existence, sort of intruding on the psyche of people in old deserted houses and things like that. But this was adapted by Simon Revelstoke, and, drawn by Richard Corbin. And it's a really cool, supernatural sort of psychological, story about, it's hard to say if it's monsters or sort of psychological powers that are sort of invading, the home where this man and his sister live alone. But it goes in some very dark directions, and the artwork is very, very cool. It's, I don't know how I would describe it. It's almost cartoony in a way, but it still sort of maintains a really, like powerful sort of like dark quality. But yeah, that was, it was a 2003 adaptation, I think, that Vertigo put out. But very, very cool. So if anybody can find that, I would track it down.
Since John mentioned Spider-Man, I have to mention that I read, the early Doctor Strange by Steve Ditko. Oh, by Steve Ditko.
I love Doctor Strange.
Kevin Woolridge just jumped for joy at that.
So it's the Ditko Stanley stuff with amazing artwork. In short review, is amazing artwork, cool stories, and bad writing.
Yeah, I'm actually, the book I'm partway through right now is Marvel 1602 that Gaiman did.
Yeah.
With Doctor Strange in a pretty prominent role. So I've had Doctor Strange on the brain.
Oh, it's a pretty cool book. There's some pretty far out visuals and some cool adventures. But yeah, Stan Lee has never been much of a writer, and with Doctor Strange is really out of his depth.
Oh, yeah. Will I, you know...
I know we're not going to start hating on Stan Lee. He's Stan Lee, for God's sakes.
Stan Lee, self-promoter extraordinaire.
The man is exuberance personified.
I take a living Jack Kirby over him any day.
Are you saying that you'd happily kill Stan Lee if Jack Kirby would come back to life?
Well, Gabe is saying is that he would love to cut out Stan Lee's still beating hurt and invoke some sort of voodoo ceremony to restore Jack Kirby.
Or if I could, like, kill Stan Lee to get to a Lazarus pit with Jack Kirby and put him in it, yeah.
Okay, at the risk of sounding like an even bigger nerd, despite the fact that I was just going, like, Spider-Man 10 minutes ago, Gabe, you put someone in a Lazarus pit, they don't come back out, right? Okay, there's something wrong with them when they come out.
Yeah, I know.
All right, you go in dead, you come out insane.
The double page spreads you get with Kirby coming out of the Lazarus pit. How insane would those be?
His eyebrows would be aflame with madness.
His cigars would be 10 feet long.
$10 says that Stan Lee has in his contract with Marvel that, you know, even after he dies, they have to prop up his skeleton in cameo roles.
I'll tell you one thing. From now on, I'm going to start using the term Kirby Crackles as a...
That would be the greatest breakfast cereal of all time.
Kirby Crackles.
Big bowl of Kirby Crackles. Awesome. Well, what do you say, guys? Is it time we wrap this thing up?
Yeah, I'd say so. This has been a horrible, horrible diversion. I can't wait to get back to Sam Peckinpah.
It's going to be gloriously violent.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess tune in, fingers crossed, next week. We have to stop making commitments, apparently.
Yeah. Well, my wife just asked me if we could do something next Tuesday or Wednesday, and I slapped her.
Oh, you know, this is a good time for a public service announcement. John and all those listeners out there, domestic violence, not to be joked about.
No, no. I saw the commercial with Mark Chopper Reed, and I'm terrified.
You feel terrible now, don't you?
I do. I love my wife.
Mm, we all do, frequently.
Dude, that was just... On that note...
I'm sorry, Mitch, the spirit of Mitch Hathaway overtook me. No, then I'd be talking about your mom, wouldn't I?
Yeah, you would be.
Sorry.
The spirit of Mitch Hathaway, we all know that your flannel shirt is going to. that keeps him out. This plant is a it's a reliquary. Now I'm picturing Hellboy in plant.
It's woven with threads from old Union uniforms, keeping anyone from Georgia at bay.
The buttons contain shavings from the Silver Cross of...
He's going to hate us.
On that, I'd like to say that we're having a... So this year, we're having so far the biggest Montreal Comic-Con so far. And Mike Mignola is going to be there.
What are the dates on that, Gabe?
Let me check. There's going to be Shatner and Malcolm McDowell and Jim Starlin, Darwin Cook, Tim Sale.
I'm pretty sure Malcolm McDowell shows up as long as you guarantee there's a table with sandwiches on it.
What about Shatner?
That's the only...
Picture Malcolm McDowell saying something, oh boy, sandwiches. His creepy Malcolm McDowell voice.
Tuna salad. Wonderful.
Oh boy, sandwiches.
Oh man, Steve's gonna have a ball editing this thing.
The he's just gonna give up and not record. This will never see the light of day on the internet.
Probably
just
not.
Send it to Staley. Just send it to Staley.
It's 14th to 16th of September.
You know, one final note that you've been talking about Comic-Cons and that. Guys, this is a bit of an ambush topic for you. You could meet one person at a sci-fi or comic convention. Who would it be?
I think I said it earlier. It would be Jack Kirby.
Jack Kirby. The Lazarus Pit. Oh, that's hard to say. Darwin Cook. You see, I've heard he's a nice guy in person, and I really like his work. So.
Terry Moore would probably be cool as well.
He seems like a decent guy. I wouldn't want to meet anyone, you know, like too famous because I just totally geek out.
With me, like if I was going to meet like a comic book writer or something, I'd have to go with Larry Hama.
Hmm.
I think that'd actually be awesome.
Time to
stop
pretend
this.
I know who he is.
Ninja again. Turtles, right?
No, what? No. No. Larry Hama wrote G.I. Joe.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
And took what was a tie into a toy property and made one of the best comics of the 80s.
Hmm. You know,
by sheer pluck.
I've never read any G.I. Joe comics. I always assumed they would be terrible.
No, man. The 80s G.I. Joe was goddamn amazing.
Oh, okay. So it's not just nostalgia that's...
No, it's not. I've got them right here on my... On my computer.
And I know that Warren Ellis wrote like adaptation, right?
He wrote an animated movie called G.I. Joe Resolute. And yeah, prior to that, well, everyone knows Warren Ellis is very English.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the closest he had ever gotten to a G.I. Joe was drinking with Larry Hama. And then he started looking into the, doing some research on it, right? Because they may not.
Hmm.
Obviously, you know, Warren Ellis doesn't just collect a paycheck. And he sat there and read it, and I think his thing was, Jesus, this is bloody Action Force. And once he recognized that, you know, they had a bit of common ground on it, then he got to work and he wrote an animated movie that it's impossible to try to gauge how much better it was than Stephen Sommers' G.I. Joe movie.
My mind is blown by the fact that there is a G.I. Joe series written by Warren Ellis, and I'd never heard about it.
Well, it was a collection of like 5-minute shorts, but they got it. They make a pretty cohesive movie. You can buy it on DVD. It's just like it's a 90-minute long feature. That is awesome.
Well, my day was just made.
Well, if that was good enough, I think that's a good enough place to stop. Having made Andrew's day.
If only everyone felt that way.
I know, I'm going to sleep well tonight.
I'm right. Just glad I can do that for you, John.
So, hopefully we'll see you next week when we discuss some Peckinpah, or otherwise we'll just hang Steve.
No, Sam Peckinpah will be next week. Tune in.